For centuries, women philosophers have been erased from intellectual history, their brilliant minds relegated to footnotes while men's ideas filled textbooks. In How to Think Like a Woman, Regan Penaluna weaves her personal journey through academia with the excavation of forgotten female thinkers who challenged philosophical traditions. Imagine walking into a graduate seminar where your professor casually asks, "Why haven't women achieved the highest levels of thought?" A question that implicitly questions your very capacity to belong in that room. This was Penaluna's awakening moment, revealing that in philosophy, she wasn't simply a thinker, but a woman thinker, a category laden with assumptions about intellectual inferiority. Growing up in Iowa with a natural inclination toward metaphysical questions, she found her intellectual home in philosophy during college, only to have graduate school gradually erode her confidence as she completed her coursework without studying a single woman philosopher. The turning point came when she discovered a footnote mentioning Damaris Cudworth, Lady Mosham, leading her to uncover brilliant women who had faced the same doubts and obstacles centuries earlier, women who had been systematically written out of history despite producing work that challenged the greatest minds of their eras. In 1694, when female literacy was rare, Mary Estelle anonymously published a serious proposal to the ladies, advocating for women's education. She argued that women were as rational as men, but socially conditioned to be submissive, a result of environment, not nature. Her boldest proposal was an all-women's college, envisioned as a sanctuary for intellectual development free from patriarchal influence. Unlike Socrates' urban dialogues, Estelle emphasized women's need for supportive community. Though successful, her book's vision was thwarted when Princess Anne's promised funding was blocked after critics likened it to a Catholic nunnery. Estelle sought to transform philosophy itself, asking, "If all men are born free, how is it that all women are born slaves?" She exposed how society celebrated men's intellectual pursuits while condemning women's, and championed the single woman as an intellectual ideal, best positioned to fulfill God's will through reason. When we remember John Stuart Mill but forget Harriet Taylor, we expose a persistent pattern: women's intellectual contributions being systematically erased. Maria von Herbert sought Kant's guidance on suicidal thoughts, engaging deeply with his moral philosophy. Kant responded dismissively, privately doubting women's capacity for reason. When Herbert later abandoned her studies for not being genius enough, Kant used their exchange as an example of warning for others. Though Mill declared works like On Liberty belonged equally to Taylor, critics dismissed her as having merely bewitched him, denying her intellectual contributions. After her death, history largely forgot her role. This pattern echoed in my relationship with Alex, a fellow philosopher whose explanations clarified difficult concepts. Our dynamic gradually eroded my confidence as I became dependent on his validation. I accepted his proposal, seeing his presence as protection in philosophy's male-dominated world. Like Alcibiades, I found both love and humiliation in my attachment to philosophy and Alex, creating dependencies that wouldn't similarly bind a man. Despite living at Cambridge University, where her father was master, Damaris Cudworth Masham was denied classical education. Meeting John Locke at 22 sparked an intellectual correspondence, though she often experienced dark moods, fits, when wrestling with philosophical questions. Their connection waned during Locke's political exile in Holland. Masham later married Sir Francis Masham, a widower with 9 children, hoping to balance intellectual and domestic life. She soon lamented to Locke that household affairs are the opium of the soul, as philosophy competed with domestic duties and her spinning wheel. As an intellectual woman in rural England, Masham faced unique challenges: intimidation of men, mockery from neighbors, and rejection by local authorities. She noted that women philosophers encountered general dislike that their male counterparts never faced. Locke's later residence in her home renewed their intellectual partnership, connecting her with prominent thinkers and enabling her to publish works defending women's intellectual capacity and advocating for their education. Women philosophers intimately understand doubt, as their judgment and authority face constant undermining. Unlike Descartes' theoretical demon, women experience self-doubt as a persistent inner voice. In my academic life, this demon questioned my worth, suggesting I was hired for my spouse rather than merit. The demon claimed I embraced weakness to avoid judgment and blamed my depression on fear of speaking up. When seeking self-respect, it demanded risk-taking, though these risks often weighed heavier for women. Even as I loved philosophy, the demon whispered there was no promise that it would love you back. Damaris Musham offered an alternative: embrace love despite its risks. Rather than seeking safety in unchanging ideals, she championed human love's messy interdependence as the path to enlightenment. This journey proves especially difficult for women, whose feelings, opinions, works, and impact are belittled, explaining their slower professional development. The struggle isn't just external barriers, but the internalized belief that intellectual value requires male validation, a pattern I recognized after leaving my marriage only to seek another man's approval. One July evening in Vermont, while studying French, I saw how I'd trapped myself in passivity. After attending a costume ball alone, my joyful reflection sparked clarity. My marriage needed to end. Days later, I told my husband Alex I couldn't continue suppressing my identity. We divorced, and I moved in with my parents, commuting to our shared college workplace. When asked about plans, I mentioned leaving my tenure-track position to possibly move to Brooklyn, Portland, or Chicago. I kept quiet about another failed relationship post-Alex. The pattern was clear. I limited myself more than others did, settling for being a sidekick despite craving independence. In October, I secured an adjunct position in New York City. Leaving job security and community terrified yet energized me. I finally understood my salvation lay within. Free from viewing myself through others' eyes, I found joy in simple pleasures, choosing meals, making friends, exploring bookstores, watching city life unfold. My days gained depth and meaning. Women philosophers have been vital contributors since philosophy's inception, offering critical perspectives on oppressive conditions. From Gargi Vachakanavi in ancient India to Charlotte Perkins Gilman challenging economic systems, these thinkers persisted despite overwhelming barriers. Catherine Trotter Cockburn, born in the 1670s, exemplifies this resilience. Orphaned young, she taught herself logic and French, writing sophisticated plays featuring rational female characters. In 1702, she published a defense of Locke's work anonymously, knowing her gender would prejudice readers. Though motherhood paused her public writing for 17 years, Cockburn continued in private, crafting fictional letters between women discussing friendship and domestic life. By 1726, with grown children, she resumed publishing philosophical works. We must reimagine the philosophical canon to reflect humanity's true intellectual journey, one that's dynamic, ever-evolving, and inclusive of women who have always been profound thinkers, despite institutional neglect.